Well, good evening to everyone here this evening. So happy to be here with you guys. We're actually going to start this evening. You know, I love visual aids, and so, yes, I have a visual aid as an introduction this evening. It's a photo, a drawing, if you will, from 1915. This was published in a London newspaper. I'd like to talk about this illustration just for a second. So the setting here is actually Christmas Day of 1914, so published like a month after it happened. And it's a scene from World War I. So this was in Belgium. The soldiers there on the right are German soldiers. The soldiers on the left are the Allied forces. So you have the British, the French, and the Belgian soldiers on the left. Before we talk about what's going on in this photo, I'd like to back up to the day before, so Christmas Eve. And on Christmas Eve, there was fighting, as you'd expect. This is trench warfare, right? So you have men entrenched along parallel trenches, shooting at each other on Christmas Eve. As the sun is going down on Christmas Eve, the shooting subsides, and suddenly the Germans put up little candles on the edge of their trenches, and maybe even some little Christmas trees. You'll see a little Christmas tree there in the photo, as a matter of fact, kind of left of center. And they begin singing Christmas carols from the trenches on the German side. The trenches at this point were so close together, they were just 100 feet apart in the narrowest of places, that the Allied forces began singing Christmas carols as well, because they could hear the Germans singing. And so they sing Christmas carols Christmas Eve, everybody goes to sleep. Christmas morning, it had snowed, it was a white Christmas, they woke up, and instead of resuming firing back and forth, as enemies would, on a battlefield, they actually emerged from the trenches and walked out and started exchanging gifts. There are stories about exchanging chocolate and candies and drinks and food, souvenirs like buttons and hats. And on Christmas Day, 1914, nearly 100,000 troops actually just got together, exchanged gifts, and had soccer matches. They played soccer on Christmas Day, 1914. These guys who had just 24 hours prior been shooting at each other were able to reconcile their differences just for a day and find some common ground on the battlefield. The truce lasted, of course, only through the end of Christmas Day, 1914, and then the fighting resumed the following day. However, I still think it's an amazing story about how it is that enemies can set aside occasionally their differences and come together even in the most horrific of circumstances. This evening, we're going to be talking more about loving our enemies, and particularly the passage that Brother Charles read to us in Luke chapter 6. And by the way, if you're interested in reading more about that, it's a really interesting event in history. You can find more online. It has its own Wikipedia page if you'd like to read more afterwards. Of course, thankfully, most of us have never been forced into the muddy trenches of a battlefield, but we all face our own enemies in our everyday lives. And of course, our default position, our human nature, is to fire back at our enemies. This evening, I'd like to think more about how we climb out of those trenches and fellowship with our enemies. We'll consider a portion of one of Jesus' famous sermons, ask what it means, how we apply it, and why we should care. So if you will, turn to Luke chapter 6 if you're not there already. I'll be reading verses 27 through 36. And we're really going to park here most of the evening. Pretty short sermon. This is really our focus this evening, is this passage. So Luke chapter 6, beginning in verse 27. But I say to you who hear, love your enemies and do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who abuse you. To one who strikes you on the cheek, offer the other also. And from one who takes away your cloak, do not withhold your tunic either. Give to everyone who begs from you, and from one who takes away your goods, do not demand them back. And as you wish that others would do to you, so do to them. If you love those who love you, what benefit is it to you? For even sinners love those who love them. And if you would do good to those who do good to you, what benefit is that to you? For even sinners do the same. And if you lend to those from whom you expect to receive, what credit is that to you? Even sinners lend to sinners to get back the same amount. But love your enemies and do good and lend, expecting nothing in return, and your reward will be great, and you will be sons of the Most High, for he is kind to the ungrateful and the evil. Be merciful, even as your Father is merciful." So this evening, again, we're answering three simple questions. The first of those questions is, what is the command here? So just a little bit of quick context. So in Luke chapter 6, if you look back a few verses at verse 13, Jesus has just named his apostles. This is part of a sermon to a large group of people. I think the ESV says a great multitude of people. Pretty similar to the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew. This one may be the same, maybe different. That's a little bit beside the point. This one was on a great plain, it says there in Luke chapter 6. But no doubt the followers, the people who were listening to the sermon, were very much like me and you, common people who had human tendencies just like us in 2019. And so what do we mean when we're referring to an enemy this evening? I'm defining that simply somebody who opposes you or frustrates you. To put that maybe in more tangible, maybe that's a bully at school, somebody who makes fun of you or puts you down at school. Maybe it's a difficult coworker. Maybe it's a family member who takes advantage of your kindness, or anyone else who's just really difficult to love. Okay, that's how we're defining an enemy this evening. And also, I'd like to say kind of up front, before we move any further, I'm not this evening addressing the topics of self-defense or national defense. I think those are other topics for another day. We can deal with those maybe in another sermon sometime. So Jesus presents here a series of four instructions to begin this section. Four instructions, pretty simple. The first one, very plain and simple, love your enemies. The second one, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, and pray for those who abuse you. So I think the first commandment there, love your enemies, pretty important to understand what those words meant when Jesus said them, right? So that love, now let me just pause for a minute and say, Kara and I both love ice cream. And not just any ice cream, we really, really like Tillamook ice cream. I don't know if any of you guys have heard Tillamook ice cream. They sell it at King Soopers. It's from Oregon. It's from Tillamook, Oregon. It is the best ice cream you can possibly imagine. I asked Kara on the way to the building this evening, what is your favorite kind of Tillamook ice cream? And she was like, I've never had a flavor of Tillamook that's not my favorite. Like, that's how good Tillamook ice cream is. Like, we no doubt love Tillamook ice cream. That's not the kind of love here. Siri's even excited about Tillamook ice cream. That's not the kind of love that we're talking about here. We're also not talking about the same type of love that I might have for Kara, or even the type of love that I might have for my brother. It's a different kind of love. And, of course, we've probably heard sermons about the Greek words for love. That's not why I'm here this evening, to go into detail about all those different types of love that the Greek language has words for. The word here that Jesus uses is agape. It's agape love. Agape love is a love that seeks nothing in return. It's an overflowing love that's not natural, right? It's a sacrificing, selfless, giving type of love. It's a love that's manifested in action. He's asking that we pour ourselves out for others and sacrifice ourselves for the good of our enemies. You can see this on display in Romans chapter 5, 5:8. In Romans says, "But God demonstrates his own love for us in this, while we were still sinners, Christ died for us." And then the three other instructions here, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, pray for those who abuse you, seem to flow, I think, from the first one, love your enemies. I had in my notes here, perhaps Jesus was emphasizing that he wasn't kidding about these other three, about what he's saying, love your enemies. Because you can imagine some of the listeners, commoners in the audience would have thought, love your enemies. That's absurd. Why would we love our enemies? Jesus, I must have misheard what Jesus just said to us, right? You figure he didn't have a microphone like this. Like, maybe they misunderstood it. But then I think the second and third and fourth reiterate, no, I'm really serious. I want you to love your enemies. This isn't, he's not exaggerating. It's not hyperbolic, right? He's saying, I really do want you to do this. He then follows up with four illustrations, I think, kind of the application part of the sermon, right? So turn the other cheek, give your shirt with your coat, give to the beggar, and do not demand that which, excuse me, do not demand back that which has been taken from you. So looking at these four illustrations, these aren't actions that we would just instinctively take. These aren't, kind of to use what I said a minute ago, kind of our default position. It's counterintuitive to act in this manner. A note on the first one there, turning the other cheek. I think maybe I had kind of misunderstood that one in the past. It's not accepting more physical violence to ourselves. In the first century, to his listeners, hitting somebody, striking someone on the cheek would have been an insult, right? In fact, this is often the way that someone would have been cast out of a synagogue, was with a slap. And if you're turning your other cheek, that would mean that you're getting a backhanded slap, which was actually doubly insulting. And under Jewish law, not to get too technical here, but the law said that that's doubly compensable, meaning that you would be receiving twice as much from the person who backhand slapped you as you would if they just like regular slapped you. So Jesus is saying, allow people to insult you, don't insult them back, take it, and receive that persecution as a blessing. I think you can see this in Paul's life, right, in the book of Acts, in particular Acts 14 and Acts 16. Paul continues ministering to people, even at the risk of further persecution. And then the other three illustrations here relate to the exercise of abundant charity without an expectation of return. And again, this is so contrary to my human nature, right? This is not what I'm inclined to naturally do. It's easy for us to show kindness to someone that we know can do something for us. I can think at work, right? If the CEO's in my office, I will drop everything and like definitely make sure that he's taken care of. But if it's somebody who like I really dislike and I know is like trying to undermine me and do something bad to me, my human tendency is not to help that person out, right? Like, that's a very difficult thing for us to do. And we have this tendency to quickly rationalize why we shouldn't help someone, particularly if we think that our charity might be abused. Jesus doesn't say, give to the beggar unless you think that he might use the money that you're giving him recklessly, right? Jesus says, give recklessly without regard to whether or not the recipient is likable or responsible. We'll circle back again to this point at the very end of our lesson, so stay tuned for more on that in just a minute. So in summary, for this first question, what is the command? We're asked to love our enemies, and the love described by Jesus is sacrificial, selfless, available, vulnerable, and subject to repeated abuse. It is evidenced through action instead of feeling. So part two of three. How do we practically do this, right? So in verse 31, Jesus gives us the golden rule, which is one of the most famous lines ever uttered by Jesus in any of his sermons. And as you wish that others would do to you, so do you to them. That's a lot easier to say than to do, right? It's easy to remember that and think, oh, do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. Easy to say, hard to put into practice. So this evening, for this kind of second part of three parts, I would like for us to think about a couple of people in the world who have done some research that I think we can tie in here. Now, let me preface this part by saying I'm not presenting these people as necessarily good examples or authoritative in any fashion. I'm only saying I think some of the research they've done is helpful, informative, and has certainly been beneficial to me on my spiritual journey. So the first person that I'd like to talk about this evening is Brené Brown. Some of you maybe have heard of Dr. Brown. She's a professor at the University of Houston. She did a TED Talk a few years ago that's like one of the most famous TED Talks ever given. And she's written a lot of best-selling books as well. She wrote a book, I think it was last year, that I read it called Braving the Wilderness. And the fourth chapter of that book is called, or titled, It's Hard to Hate, Close Up, Move In. Dr. Brown's point is that it's easy for us to hate large groups of people, but difficult for us to take one person from that group and hate him or her. I'm actually going to read one passage here from that chapter of Dr. Brown's book, where she says, the men and women with the strongest sense of true belonging stay zoomed in. They don't ignore what is happening in the world, nor do they stop advocating for their beliefs. They do, however, commit to assessing their lives and forming their opinions of people based on their actual in-person experiences. They work against the trap that most of us have fallen into. I can hate large groups of strangers because the members of those groups who I happen to know and like are the rare exceptions. So what does all that mean? What is Dr. Brown trying to say? She's trying to say that we must spend time with our enemies and truly get to know them. We must listen to them in the same way that we would like to be understood. Kind of on a personal note, on a personal level here, I can think, I grew up in a very conservative family, and I think I was guilty of really making broad categorizations about progressives and liberals. And then I went to law school, and I was kind of compelled to work alongside these individuals and eat lunch with them, study for exams with them, and really get to know them. And I can think of a couple of instances where I sat down with people who were like completely my opposite from an ideological standpoint, right? Like, they are like way on the other end of the spectrum. And I realized, like, yeah, like, I disagree with them, but they're actually like decent people. Like, they have some of the same problems that I have. They have families. They have, you know, they're buying groceries in the same place. Like, we have a lot in common. And I suddenly realized it's hard to blanket that whole group as being my enemy when I know that I have friends in that group, right? Does that make sense? So I think that's what Dr. Brown is getting at. It's hard to hate close up. If you get to know someone from a group that you really despise, and I'm not saying, and I don't think Brown is saying this either, you don't have to agree with them, but just get to know them. There's a lot of value in that. That's the first. Second point, two of two here. You're going to say motivation, attribution, asymmetry. Ben, that is, whew, that's a big one for a Sunday night. Professor Adam Waits is a really interesting professor at Northwestern University. He teaches at the business school, the Kellogg School of Management. He's done a lot of research on behavioral economics and how big groups of people get along, which, again, you're thinking, wow, that sounds like a lot. So let me read just a really, like, three lines from his kind of a summary of his work. These studies show that in political and ethno-religious intergroup conflict, adversaries tend to attribute their own group's aggression to in-group love more than out-group hate, and to attribute their out-group's aggression to out-group hate more than in-group love. And right now you're like, what in the world even did Ben just say? That's fair. That's a lot to process. So let's just say, in other words, don't assume the worst about people who aren't like you. And you might think, well, I don't need a professor of psychology to tell me that, but I think his work is pretty interesting. It means that we tend to think of ourselves as motivated by love. You think about this in large group. He looked at like Palestinians and Israelis and like that conflict, and even Democrats and Republicans in our country. We tend to think that our side is motivated by love and assume that the other side is motivated by hate, right? And that it can't be true, right? Like, not everybody, not every conflict can be lined up that way, where one side is hating, one side is loving, right? And so I think the key there is to overcome that by realizing that we have to seek some common ground and recognize that the other side is not always motivated by hate. And that's kind of an absurd position to take, that we're the only ones who are loving and everyone else is malicious and trying to hate their way through this battle, right? That they're our enemies because they hate us. And to circle back to the beginning, the illustration that we used at the very, on the first slide, the Allied troops and the German troops climbed out of the trenches on Christmas Eve because they were singing Christmas carols together, right? Like, that's ultimately what caused them to start reconciling and finding some common ground because of something as simple as a Christmas carol, right? And so maybe it is that we can seek and look at our enemies and find, okay, well, maybe your kids go to school together. Maybe you walk your dogs at the same dog park. Or maybe you listen to the same sort of music, trying to seek some common ground with our enemies to build those bridges and stand up out of the trenches. And then the third question this evening, the last. This is part 3 of 3. Why should we do this? I have two reasons here, and they're both in the text. They're in Luke chapter 6. The first one is pretty simple. Stand out from the world. If we're just like the world, we'll continue spiraling downward. There's an example that I heard in a sermon, actually from Martin Luther King Jr. And he gave this example from his own life experience where he and his brother were driving in a car late at night on the highway, and the cars approaching them on this highway, without exception, kept leaving their high beams on, right? Which, you know, the frustration. It's really blinding when somebody's driving at you with their high beams. And so Martin was the passenger. His brother was the driver. His brother was like, well, you know what? Forget it. I'll just leave my lights on high beam and just give it back to them, right? Because I hate this. This is stupid that I'm going to turn mine down, but they'll leave theirs on. And Martin Luther King made the point. That is so destructive, right? Like, you're only asking for a wreck, some catastrophe to occur, if both drivers, despite the other, are going to continue leaving their high beams on. That's so ridiculous and so destructive. And so Martin Luther explained that something has to change, right? Like, somebody has to be the bigger person and say, all right, we'll turn the low beams on and show some love here. A good quote here. Men must see that force begets force, hate begets hate, toughness begets toughness. And it is all a descending spiral, ultimately ending in destruction for all and everybody. Somebody must have sense enough and morality enough to cut off the chain of hate and the chain of evil in the universe. And you do that by love. And I think that's spot on. I think Jesus is telling us in Luke chapter 6 that our love for our enemies is what makes us stand out from everyone else, and that's how we cut this pattern of hate and evil that's perpetuated in the world. And ultimately, of course, our love as Christians is how people in the world know that, in fact, we are Christians. As Jesus finished washing his disciples' feet in John chapter 13, what did he say? He said, so now I am giving you a new commandment, love each other. Just as I have loved you, you should love each other. Your love for one another will prove to the world that you are my disciples. And the second point here is pretty simple as well. It's to be more like Christ. In verse 35, there in Luke chapter 6, if you're still there, in verse 35 it says, you will be sons of the Most High, for he is kind to the ungrateful and the evil. So I'd actually kind of like to wrap this up by thinking back to the first slide where I listed out the instructions and the illustrations, right? So do you remember on the instruction side, the left-hand side there, it said, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, and pray for those who abuse you. And so if you kind of take those four and take a step back, you can personalize it and say, Jesus loved me when I was his enemy. Jesus did good to me when I hated him. Jesus blessed me despite my curses. And Jesus prayed for me. John 17 is a good example of that. And to think about the love that was shown by Jesus, he didn't put parameters on his love and say that he'd only love me if I'm willing to fulfill certain conditions. That he didn't want to be, you know, reckless with his love. He wanted to make sure that he's giving his love to the right people. He didn't do anything like that, right? And that wouldn't make sense if he did. He loved me with complete, sacrificial, reckless love. The same sort of agape love that we're called to share with others even today. Jesus loved me wholly, selflessly, sacrificially, which is the greatest example of how we then should turn around and love our own enemies, right? My natural reaction then is to reciprocate that love that was shown to me on the cross, but to show that to my enemies every day. So it's time for us to consider climbing out of the trenches to extend a hand to the other side, to look at our enemies and try to find some common ground, to live or to love with a sacrificial love that's not thinking about what can this person give to me, but instead, how can I break that chain of hate and climb up out of the trenches and reconcile with the enemy? And again, I would say, I'm definitely not saying here tonight that I'm advocating that we adopt the enemy's views. That's certainly absolutely not what I'm suggesting. I'm merely suggesting that when Jesus said we should love our enemies, we should actually really love our enemies. And that is super difficult to do. It's easy to talk about and mention in a prayer now and again, but to actually put that into practice is something that's really profound. And I hope that the 20, 25 minutes that we've spent together this evening has given you a little bit more to think about this week as you go out into the world and confront your own enemies, hopefully in a loving manner, as Jesus would have. So if you're not a follower of Christ this evening, you are living in opposition to God. And that sounds pretty harsh and pretty strong language, but it's the truth. And however much you oppose God, He still loves you very much, and He desires for you to turn away from the world and to follow Him. And maybe it is that you're here this evening and you have made that commitment in the past to lay your arms down and to go and follow Jesus. But somewhere along the line, you've fallen, you've become entrenched again, and you're fighting with enemies, and you're not displaying and giving that love, the agape love that Jesus calls His followers to give. Certainly, we'd be happy to pray with you, and whether or not it's publicly here in front of everybody, even if you just need to approach someone afterwards and talk through it, certainly would encourage you to do that as well. If there's anything at all that we can do this evening to help you, we would invite you to come forward as we stand and sing.